Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is one of the preeminent thinkers on 21st century warfare and American security policy. Currently a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation, Peter Singer has been called one of the top 100 global thinkers by Foreign Policy Journal, and Defense News has named him one of the top 100 influential people on defense issues. In his books, writing as P.W. Singer, he was the first to explore the outsourcing of military services for hire by private companies in his book, Corporate Warriors. Wired for War looks at the robotics and drone technology at use on the contemporary battlefield and looks at how this technology will be used in future conflicts. Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know, which is actually the title of his lecture this evening, examines the essential questions about this new form of security and threats and the broad disconnect between those IT professionals who truly understand the threats and executives and policymakers who largely don't. Singer's latest book, Ghost Fleet, is actually a novel about what a 21st century global war will look like, with conflict on land, air, and sea, along with cyberspace and actual space. Singer was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night and will be speaking tonight at 7:30 at Helmer Hall on the TU campus in a free lecture on his book, Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know. Peter Singer is my guest today. Peter Singer, welcome back to Tulsa and welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Now, your latest book takes all this work you've done in cybersecurity and write a novel about the next world war, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But you're here in Tulsa to talk about cybersecurity and cyber war. There's this big disconnect between the people who actually know what the real threats in cybersecurity and, quote, cyber war are, and policymakers that are responsible for determining responses to that. Can you talk about that disconnect?
Well, the topic of cybersecurity is an interesting one because it's important to us all on multiple levels. And it's very rare to find a topic like that. It matters to you on the personal level, you know, the security of your bank account, the privacy of your personal information. It matters on an organizational level, whether you work in a business or a military unit or a university or a radio station, there's cybersecurity issues. And then finally, it matters on a national political level. It's a national security question. It affects global politics, you name it. So it's very hard to find topics like that that connect all of them together. But I like to joke that it's been largely left to the IT crowd, to the IT folks to understand and handle. And yet, whether it's a political issue or if we're looking at how we understand breaches at major retail companies, it's very rarely just a technology issue. It's always a human issue. And the responsibility for how we either prevent it or we manage the problem is very rarely just about the technology. And so what we tried to accomplish in the book is to try to demystify this realm with the idea that if we're ever going to feel secure, if we're ever going to get out of cyber insecurity, it has to become an issue for us all to handle.
One of the things you've talked about is the fact that, you know, if you're becoming an MBA candidate, you don't have any training in this. If you're going through, say, the Kennedy School of Government or, you know, any number of training grounds for diplomats or policymakers, there's not a whole lot of training for this. This is within that cybersecurity realm where they're all insular for the most part.
And you can come at that a number of different ways. You can come at it by the numbers. For example, 70% of business execs in general, not tech, not security execs, but business execs in general have made some kind of cybersecurity decision for their company, 70%. And yet if you look, as just what you're noting, if you look at the training grounds for those executives, the MBA programs, there are elective courses for people who are already interested in it, but at no major MBA school are they teaching as part of your normal management responsibility, the way they do other parts of the job. Same thing at the schools we teach our lawyers, our journalists, our diplomats. There's this gap there, and that's for the next generation, let alone we were talking about people who are already in positions of power, and you know, you can come at that either through the numbers or through anecdotes. And, you know, my favorite illustration of that is the former Secretary of Homeland Security talking about how she didn't use email. And the reason she didn't use email wasn't out of a sense of security or privacy. It's because she considered it a waste of time. And again, like, maybe email is a waste of time, but everyone's using it whether it's in your agency to the businesses you're trying to protect. Oh, by the way, terrorists and the like. And so if you consider this whole domain a waste of time, you're not going to be able to approach it in a very thoughtful manner.
So what risk does that run when you have decision makers for a lot, whether it's corporations or government, that really don't understand the threat, don't understand the likely or unlikelihood, for that matter, of a given threat?
You get caught between two spaces here where either we see businesses or universities or whatnot, individuals not doing enough to protect themselves, not taking the threat seriously or mishandling in some manner, or at the other end of the spectrum, being taken in by what I call cyber hucksters, people or businesses that promise them, you know, 100% security if they just buy their secret sauce, their special widget, or if they just hand the problem over to them and, oh, by the way, hand over some of your rights too. That's what we're kind of caught between these two spaces, because it's a space that it's not well understood, and therefore it's also scary, and so people can take advantage of your fears. And, you know, the way out of this is we're going to have to treat it, as I was getting, you know, it's a problem that everyone's going to be dealing with, whether you're in technology or not. It's going to have to be woven into our training and education, whether it's at the college graduate school level, all the way down to, you know, I think of our kids. To illustrate this, very basic cyber hygiene would stop roughly 90% of all attacks. Now, parallel to, we teach our kids basic hygiene. Again, basic hygiene doesn't protect you against every health threat out there, but it's a very good thing to have. Think about how much time our kids spend online. Think about how much access that opens up to other things. And yet we don't teach them cyber hygiene in their schools. And that goes all the way up to, you know, when businesses, CEOs or senators or judges, as they're looking at their day-to-day responsibilities, they're going to have to start thinking about cybersecurity woven into this. I'm not saying they're going to, you know, be running the software packages on their computer, but they're going to have to decide for themselves, am I doing enough? Or am I being taken advantage of? How am I going to be thoughtful about this problem over the long term?
You also have talked about the idea that the IT crowd, the IT crowd, need to do a better job of talking to the user. So, you know, being a radio station user, when the IT person starts talking to me, it's like there's a little glaze.
Exactly. They get what we call it, the glaze, where they kind of look back and they nod
no
their
idea.
Head occasionally, but they don't understand. And again, that's on both parties. It's
right.
On one part of the people. You know, I remember this politician, you know, saying, oh, this is just like when I try and, you know, program my VCR. It's like thinking like, God, you're still using a VCR. I mean, that's endemic to the problem. But it's the other part is if the tech folks are speaking in a manner that's not well understood, that can't be understood. And you can see this, you know, within businesses, some of the worst breaches for, you know, major retail companies, the cost of that breach has been determined not by how their, you know, whatever software package they bought. It's been the communication problem between the IT department and the rest of the business. And then in turn, how the rest of the business handled it, you know, whether it was their public affairs or their legal department or even their CEOs, you know, and you can, there's major department stores have gone through this where it was how they handled or arguably mishandled the communication side is really what determined it from being a loss measured in millions to measured over $1 billion.
Let me ask you about that frequency, because I think I heard one thing you said. You said probably 97% of the major retailers have had a hacking incident, and the other three have refused to acknowledge it.
Yeah, so this is a problem that strikes at all levels and strikes almost every business. So of Fortune 500 companies, 97% admit that they've been breached at some point, that they've been hacked. The other 3%, you know, they have been. They're just not willing to admit it. It's all the way down to medium and small business. One survey found that 70% had dealt with some kind of cybersecurity incident in the last year. And again, the incidents will range from an external hack by, you know, be it Chinese intelligence or a Russian criminal network, to just someone within your small business who's accessing customer information in a way that they shouldn't. And the move forward on this is that we're starting to see changes in how the law is dealing with it, but also we're Americans. In the absence of law, we turn to lawsuits. So we're seeing a lot of lawsuits playing out. And so, again, we're building up a sense of accountability that you at least have to meet some kind of, you know, market standards right now if you want to deal with this problem.
Do you see this problem abating as, say, more digital natives populate business and government, as opposed to my generation, for example, or the generation that's older than me, that still there's this wonderful mystery?
So you've got these different trends in place. So you could say on one hand, oh, great, we're going to get the, you know, the digital natives. We're going to get people who grew up with computers, and they'll take over, and they'll be much more informed on this than the person with the VCR.
But they just may be a consumer.
Well, a couple things there. One, just because you were born into this world doesn't mean you're automatically understand it, particularly if the education system is not linking into it. So if you're coming out of, you know, as you mentioned, of an MBA program right now, doesn't mean you're inherently good at it just because you were born in, you know, whatever the 90s. The second thing is we don't have time. There are some areas, you know, maybe like, you know, Silicon Valley, where, yeah, you can be a 26-year-old CEO. But in other areas, you know, be it law, be it politics, be it the military, be it, you know, most regular business, that 20-year-old is not going to be in a position to make powerful decisions for a decade, two decades. And we've got all of these things happening in the interim. And a big part of this is, you know, as we know the way bureaucracies work, once a decision is made, say now, by someone in power, it's going to be sticky. So if we make the wrong decisions now, it's going to have consequences for the long term. And then the final thing is, yes, as you get more and more people trained up in this space, it doesn't mean that the threat side's going away. And so it's just as active. So I don't take the attitude that we can just wait this out.
From what I hear from IT professionals and people that do this for a living, those threats are affecting nearly everywhere, nearly every week, every day. I mean, even our little, you know, at the radio station, we have some automated things. There are probes made
exactly
fairly
so that,
regularly.
So we need to change our attitude from being one of thinking about this either, and I'm not going to do anything, to the other attitudes are defense or deterrence. Defense, I can keep the bad guy out all the time. Well, you can't. Sorry to tell you that. Anyone who says that you can, they're a huckster. In fact, the bad guy may already be on the inside. You know, that was the problem, for example, for Manning or Snowden within U.S. military organizations. It's the same thing in terms of deterrence, is the idea that you can scare the bad guy away. No, you're not going to be able to scare all bad guys away. Some may not be deterrable. Terrorists, for example, are not deterrable. Say to a terrorist in the real world, if you do X, you'll die. Well, a suicide bomber would say, yeah, that's kind of my plan. So the point is not to think that, you know, it's not to ignore the threat, not to think you can always keep it out. There's value in defense, but instead is to move to a mentality that we call resilience. And resilience, you know, just like in the rest of life, is accepting that bad things will happen. It's all about how are you going to power through them? How are you going to shrug them off? How are you going to protect the most important information? How are you going to bounce back quickly when you get knocked back down? How are you setting up insurance for when the bad things happen? So I'm hoping that, again, we can adopt more of a resilience model, whether it's national level to your radio station, your business, all the way down to yourself. You know, we think about resilience in our own personal lives. You know, we've got certain things that you put in a lockbox because you think they're more important. You make copies of because you think they're more important. We need to be doing the same in the digital space.
Yeah, you have your tornado shelter in Oklahoma.
Exactly, and you have insurance for your home and for your car,
right,
both because you're incentivized to do it. No, by the way, there's a little bit of regulation that forces you to do it. And then insurance having this both sets a marketplace that drives people towards better behavior. But oh, by the way, it backstops you when the real bad things happen.
My guest today is Peter Singer, who writes under the name P.W. Singer, a writer and specialist on 21st century warfare, a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation. His most recent books are titled Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know, which he'll be talking about at the University of Tulsa campus this evening at 7:30, and Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war. Let's talk about this. You've been dealing with the real world for a long time, and now you've sort of put it into a novel. In your book, Wired for War, This was now 6 years ago, and you were writing about lots of technologies that seem fanciful. Has the real-world application of a lot of those fanciful technologies accelerated beyond what your expectation was, or is it moving about the right speed?
No, it's definitely accelerated, and it's accelerated not just in the technology, but our use of it. So Wired for War, for example, looked at drones, robotics, and right. Go back a couple years ago, that was all science fiction, and now it's the centerpiece of everything from American defense strategy to we're seeing them used on the domestic front and everything from farming to journalism to recreation. I got two different drones for Christmas last year. So Ghost Fleet's a little bit different. What it is it's a smash-up. It's a smash-up of a techno thriller. It's in the style of early Tom Clancy. It tells the story of what would happen if there was a war in the 2020s. But it also is packed with nonfiction. And so another way of putting it is that it's a novel about a war that hasn't happened. It features a lot of things that seem like science fiction, the next generation of drones, cyber attacks, artificial intelligence,
satellite,
space warfare, yeah, right. You name it. Mm-hmm. But it comes with 400 endnotes to document how every single technology in it, whether it's a brain hacking device to a Chinese aircraft carrier, even some of the things that the characters say, their quotes are pulled from the real world. And so it's bringing together Tom Clancy and adding that extra layer of realism. And I use that Tom Clancy also of the writing style because I grew up reading and loving some of the early Tom Clancy, the Red Storm Rising.
Right. That was a very realistic idea of what a Warsaw Pact attack on the West would look like.
Yeah. And so, there's a couple of things to parallel there. One is it was just a fun reading experience, but also the stakes. Back then, the idea of a third world war was, something that was on everybody's mind. It was something, that we were afraid of. Fortunately, the Cold War never turned hot, but that what if was something that I think was important to explore. Well, since then, conflict didn't go away, but it was seemingly pushed down a level to, failed states, insurgencies, terrorism. But now as we look around, some of these fears are resurfacing. We can see it, tensions with Russia. NATO's on its highest level alert since the 1980s after Russia's land grab in the Ukraine. We have visits by Russian bombers to California's borders. To tensions with China, we have the rise of a new great power that we're in an arms race in. And so the what if of, what if there was a war, not against guerrilla fighters or terrorists, but with states, a big war that would involve, battles in the air, at sea, on land, space, cyberspace. It's something that, was unthinkable a couple years ago, and it's becoming, it's not inevitable. I'm not saying this is something that will happen, but it's definitely something that is becoming thinkable, and so those stakes are worth exploring. It explores what would happen if the U.S. went to war with China, and I jokingly call it China's junior partner that doesn't realize it's the junior Russia. And, what would a war between great powers look like in the 21st century?
So one of the things that the book points out is the fact that, well, for example, a lot of the companies we're doing for military technology, be it cyber technology or weaponry, they come from outside of the United States these days. How important is that?
So there's all sorts of ways that this kind of conflict would differ, and it's everything from the domains in which we would fight. We've not fought a major battle at sea for 70 years. We've not fought a peer in the air for 70 years. We've never fought in space. We've never truly had cyber war. To another difference is the advantage of technology. The last 70 years, the U.S. has always been a generation ahead in our technology. It's not always delivered absolute victory, but we've never gone into a fight either equal or behind the other side in technology. And that's something that might be different looking forward. And then this final thing that you hit on is that when you've got powers coming together, they not only both sides have high technology, but they can go after each other's technology vulnerabilities. Some of it might have been what we were talking about before, hacking, you know, doing things like taking down GPS, so suddenly your missiles can't find themselves, to knocking down satellites so that you don't have the kind of information or communication we've grown used to. And again, this would apply not just in battle, but the rest of the economy too. It would touch America in a way we haven't, you know, frankly, we didn't even touch this back in World War II. But also the difference, another difference with back then is the supply chain and the fact that we are weirdly dependent on potential adversaries in the way we've never been before. So let me give you a pointed illustration of this. The Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35, is this new fighter jet that we're in the midst of spending over $1 trillion, that's trillion with a T, dollars on. It's the most advanced fighter jet in the U.S. system. Unfortunately, that program, it's been hacked on at least three separate occasions. So China has already developed its, we could almost describe it as a twin. People can look online, Google F-35 and J-31, and they'll be like, wow, these two planes look alike. How's that? So one, that software problem. But second, over 70% of the microchips inside our F-35 jet are made and designed in China and Taiwan. So you have the opportunity of what they call a hardware hack. So it's not just you're dependent on the other side for getting the microchips. It's the worry of what might they do with those chips.
Some sort of backdoor.
Right? Yeah, and for people who love science fiction, basically what we're talking about here is the real world version of the opening scene from Battlestar Galactica happening. And it, you know, it's weird to say this is sci-fi, but it's something that is spooked a great number of people in the military. And one of the fun experiences for me with this book is it's a novel, but the fans, so to speak, for it have ranged from, you know, people in the fiction world, but also the head of the U.S. Navy. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs had us come in and brief on real-world lessons.
How plausible do you think that sort of global war? I mean, it's hard to think that that threat will ever go away as long as humans populate this Earth. But there is one other aspect, which without giving away anything, there's another difference between the last time we had a world war, and that is globalized corporations that are really not, even if they're based in the United States, they're not really completely here at home. They're everywhere. They're around the world.
Yeah.
So, and the same with the China and Russia.
Yeah. So we, the characters in the book are all based on the real world people who might fight in such a war. And I should add the structure of it is not following a single character. It's rather like a cast of characters in multiple locations. And so they range from the ones that you would expect, you know, like fighter pilots, Navy ship captains, Chinese generals, and then ones that we don't expect, but we should. And one is the setting of exploring how, you know, America's economy is different and the world economy is different than back then. And you have these multinational corporations. You also have the hubs of the American economy. So it's not Detroit anymore. It's, you know, Silicon Valley, or it's companies hubbed in Bentonville, Arkansas. And yet these companies, they're multinational. And so the questions that they'll have to navigate are, you know, everything from, do we go with where we're founded? Do we go with where our business is? Do we go with where our shareholders are? These can be very different. And so the settings, you know, some of the battles or scenes, some of them are taking place in, you know, jet fighter battles or at war, ships at sea, what a 21st century naval battle would look like. But there's another one that's at a Walmart shareholder meeting where they're basically having a debate on, you know, what do we as a corporation do in this space?
My guest today is Peter Singer, strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation. He's the author of numerous books, most of them nonfiction on everything from drones in the future. And you were talking about drones earlier. I have to mention I was watching this super lunar eclipse two nights ago, and right up where the moon was, there was this blinking red light that turned green and then went back to red. And, you know, 15 years ago, we would have said, UFO. And, of course, it was a drone. Taking technology is everywhere. He'll be speaking on cybersecurity and cyber war, what everyone needs to know, tonight at 7:30 at Helmrich Hall in the University of Tulsa campus. And his most recent book is this novel of the next world war called Ghost Fleet. And the Ghost Fleet is actually what we would think of the fleet, right?
It's actually the Navy's nickname for the real-world ships that make up the National Defense Reserve Fleet. They're the old retired ships, which we keep just in case of emergency. They're the Navy's version, as some people may be familiar with, the Air Force Boneyard, the old jets we keep out in the desert. So it's a play on words, but it also kind of explores this, you know, what would ever have to happen where you would need these old ships? And then how would you bring them back and the interaction of the old and the new guard? And, you know, you get to have a lot of fun with that from a character standpoint. But again, it's not made up. There are real ships that are out there that are kept in reserve just in case.
And there are no computers on them. Well, let me ask you one last question. That has to do with the idea of cybersecurity. What are the scenarios that sort of you wake up in the middle of the night that worry you about where we are today and where we're likely to go in the next couple of years?
Well, I think, you know, there's obvious concern about large scale, you know, the phrasings people use or cyber Pearl Harbor, cyber 9/11. There are real risks of that, but that scenario has been, frankly, a little bit overblown. So my favorite example of this would be, you know, we talk about, oh, my God, and the whole power grid might go out. Squirrels have taken down more power grids in the zero times that hackers have. Doesn't mean hackers won't, but it just means we've figured out how to be resilient against squirrels. We can do this. My bigger concern is the long-term consequence of intellectual property theft, the long-term consequence of business secrets being stolen. And the business secrets range from, you know, the designs, as we mentioned, of sophisticated jet fighters to energy companies have lost the designs for sophisticated drilling equipment to your intellectual property might be your negotiating strategy, what you were planning to do when you're going into a bid against someone else. To continue with that energy example, because I know we're here in Oklahoma, energy companies have gone against foreign competitors in a bidding war or for identifying certain blocks and the other side has hacked them and knows what they're going to bid so they can easily win. So it's all the way down to universities have been hacked, professors' research has been stolen, to small furniture makers have gone out of business because they've seen their best-selling chair stolen and recreated by a Chinese company online. So the problem is you can look at each one of these cases individually, and it's bad for that individual company. When you bundle them all together, it has huge national and economic security consequences. And that, to me, is a big long-term kind of, you know, I don't want to say it's slow moving because it's happening all over, but it's not as sexy as a, you know, single the power goes out scenario, but it may actually matter more in the long term.
Will that eventually sort itself out, do you think? Because, you know, I mean, I think of the United States when it was a growing nation in the 19th century, copyright was still evolving. But of course, you know, you had authors that were copyrighted in Europe that you could basically, you know, there was no copyright for
and
those.
And my British
in the
friends
States,
are happy to remind, you know, me about, you know, Americans stole the ideas of, you know, the early ways to set up factories and steam engines and the like. You know, we used to steal intellectual property. It's something that you hope might work itself in the long term. And the mechanisms for this are everything from does China's rise move it from changing its attitude towards intellectual property, where if it's creating more of its own,
yeah,
it
has more to lose.
That's one argument. To the recent summit that just happened in Washington, D.C., there was an agreement, I put that in quotation marks, an agreement where the two sides said, you know, we'll stealing intellectual property, stealing business secrets, neither side should do that. It's a nice agreement. We'll see what happens next. There's no underlying enforcement mechanism to, despite all the things that have been happening, China has consistently denied it. So it's kind of easy to agree to something that you've always denied doing anyway.
I'll leave it there. Peter Singer, thanks very much for joining us.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation, Peter Singer, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He writes under the name P.W. Singer, and his most recent book is a novel, Ghost Fleet, A Novel of the Next World War. He'll be speaking on his previous book, Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know, in a free lecture this evening at 7:30 in Helmer Call on the University of Tulsa campus. For more information on his most recent book, visit ghostfleetbook.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.